The ship was still only 30 days from Earth, yet David Bowman sometimes found it hard to believe that he had ever known any other existence than the closed little world of Discovery. All his years of training, all his earlier missions to the Moon and Mars, seemed to belong to another man in another life. Frank Poole admitted to the same feelings, and had sometimes jokingly regretted that the nearest psychiatrist was the better part of 100 million miles away. But this sense of isolation and estrangement was easy enough to understand, and certainly indicated no abnormality. In the 50 years since men had ventured into space, there had never been a mission quite like this. It had begun 5 years ago as Project Jupiter, the first manned round trip to the greatest of the planets. The ship was nearly ready for the 2-year voyage when, somewhat abruptly, the mission profile had been changed. Discovery would still go to Jupiter, but she would not stop there. She would not even slacken speed as she raced through the far-ranging Jovian satellite system. On the contrary, she would use the gravitational field of the giant world as a sling to cast her even further from the sun. Like a comet, she would streak on across the outer reaches of the solar system to her ultimate goal, the ringed glory of Saturn. And she would never return. For Discovery, it would be a one-way trip. Yet her crew had no intention of committing suicide. If all went well, they would be back on Earth within 7 years, 5 of which would pass like a flash in the dreamless sleep of hibernation, while they waited rescue by the still unbuilt Discovery II. The word rescue was carefully avoided in all the Astronautics Agency's statements and documents. It implied some failure of planning, and the approved jargon was reacquisition. If anything went really wrong, there would certainly be no hope of rescue, almost 1 billion miles from Earth. It was a calculated risk, like all voyages into the unknown, but half a century of research had proved that artificially induced human hibernation was perfectly safe, and it had opened up new possibilities in space travel. Not until this mission, however, had they been exploited to their utmost. The 3 members of the survey team, who would not be needed until the ship entered her final orbit around Saturn, would sleep through the entire outward flight. Tons of food and other expendables would thus be saved. Almost as important, the team would be fresh and alert, and not fatigued by the 10-month voyage when they went into action. Discovery would enter a parking orbit around Saturn, becoming a new moon of the giant planet. She would swing back and forth along a 2-million-mile ellipse that took her close to Saturn and then across the orbits of all its major moons. They would have 100 days in which to map and study a world with 80 times the area of Earth and surrounded by a retinue of at least 15 known satellites, one of them as large as the planet Mercury. At the end of the 100 days, Discovery would close down. All the crew would go into hibernation. Only the essential systems would continue to operate, watched over by the ship's tireless electronic brain. She would continue to swing around Saturn on an orbit now so well determined that men would know exactly where to look for her 1,000 years hence. But in only 5 years, according to present plans, Discovery II would come. Even if 6 or 7 or 8 years elapsed, her sleeping passengers would never know the difference. For all of them, the clock would have stopped, as it had stopped already for Whitehead, Kaminsky, and Hunter. Sometimes Bowman, as first captain of Discovery, envied his 3 unconscious colleagues in the frozen peace of the hibernaculum. They were free from all boredom and all responsibility. Until they reached Saturn, the external world did not exist. But that world was watching them, through their biosensor displays. Tucked in conspicuously away among the massed instrumentation of the control deck were 5 small panels, marked Hunter, Whitehead, Kaminsky, Poole, Bowman. The last 2 were blank and lifeless. Their time would not come until a year from now. The others bore constellations of tiny green lights, announcing that everything was well. Though the low-thrust plasma drive had long since been closed down, Discovery was still coasting with her slender, arrow-like body pointed away from Earth, and all her high-powered optical gear was orientated towards the other planets where her destiny lay. There was one telescope, however, that was permanently aimed at Earth. It was mounted like a gun sight on the rim of the ship's long-range antenna, and checked that the great parabolic bowl was rigidly locked upon its distant target. While Earth remained centered in the crosswires, the vital communication link was intact, and messages could come and go along the invisible beam that lengthened more than 2 million miles with every day that passed. At least once in every watch period, Bowman would look homeward through the antenna alignment telescope. As Earth was now far back towards the sun, its darkened hemisphere faced discovery, and on the central display screen the planet appeared as a dazzling silver crescent, like another Venus. There were periods when, as the moon swung back and forth in its orbit, it shone down like a great lamp upon the darkened seas and continents of Earth. Then, with a thrill of recognition, Bowman could often glimpse familiar coastlines, shining in that spectral light. Yet he had no regrets for those lost beauties. He had enjoyed them all in his 35 years of life, and he was determined to enjoy them again when he returned rich and famous. Meanwhile, distance made them all the more precious. The sixth member of the crew cared for none of these things, for it was not human. It was the highly advanced HAL-9000 computer, the brain and nervous system of the ship. HAL, for heuristically programmed algorithmic computer, no less, was a machine intelligence that could reproduce, some philosophers still prefer to use the word mimic, most of the activities of the human brain, and with far greater speed and reliability. It was extremely expensive, and only a few units of the HAL 9000 series had yet been built, but the old jest that it would always be easier to make organic brains by unskilled labor was beginning to sound a little hollow. HAL had been trained for this mission as thoroughly as his human colleagues, and at many times their rate of input, for in addition to his intrinsic speed, he never slept. His prime task was to monitor the life support systems, continually checking oxygen pressure, temperature, hull leakage, radiation, and all the other interlocking factors upon which the lives of the fragile human cargo depended. He could carry out the intricate navigational corrections and execute the necessary flight maneuvers when it was time to change course, and he could watch over the hibernators, making any necessary adjustments to their environment and doling out the minute quantities of intravenous fluids that kept them alive. The first generations of computers had received their inputs through glorified typewriter keyboards and had replied through high-speed printers and visual displays. HAL could do this when necessary, but most of his communication with his shipmates was by means of the spoken word. Poole and Bowman could talk to HAL as if he were a human being, and he would reply in the perfect idiomatic English he had learned during the fleeting weeks of his electronic childhood. Whether HAL could actually think was a question which had been settled by the British mathematician Alan Turing back in the 1940s. Turing had pointed out that if one could carry out a prolonged conversation with a machine, whether by typewriter or microphone was immaterial, without being able to distinguish between its replies and those that a man might give, then the machine was thinking, by any sensible definition of the word. HAL could pass the Turing test with ease. The time might even come when HAL would take command of the ship. In an emergency, if no one answered his signals, he would attempt to wake the sleeping members of the crew by electrical and chemical stimulation. If they did not respond, he would radio Earth for further orders. And then, if there was no reply from Earth, he would take what measures he deemed necessary to safeguard the ship and to continue the mission, whose real purpose he alone knew, and which his human colleagues could never have guessed. Bowman's day began at 1600 ship's time. His first official act of the day would be to advance the master hibernation timer 12 hours. If this operation was missed twice in a row, HAL would assume that both he and Poole had been incapacitated and would take the necessary emergency action. Bowman would attend to his toilet and do his isometric exercises before settling down to breakfast and the morning's radio fax edition of the World Times. On Earth, he never read the paper as carefully as he did now. Even the smallest items of society gossip, the most fleeting political rumors, seemed of absorbing interest as it flashed across the screen. At 0700, he would officially relieve Poole on the control deck, bringing him a squeeze tube of coffee from the kitchen. If, as was usually the case, there was nothing to report and no action to be taken, he would settle down to check all the instrument readings and would run through a series of tests designed to spot possible malfunctions. By 1000 hours, this would be finished, and he would start on a study period. He would prowl endlessly over ship's plans, circuit diagrams, and voyage profiles, or would try to assimilate all that was known about Jupiter, Saturn, and their far-ranging families of moons. After lunch from 1300 to 1600, Bowman would make a slow and careful tour of the ship, or such part of it as was accessible. Discovery measured almost 400 feet from end to end, but the little universe occupied by her crew lay entirely inside the 40-foot sphere of the pressure hull. Here were all the life support systems and the control deck, which was the operational heart of the ship. Below this was a small space garage, fitted with three airlocks through which powered capsules, just large enough to hold a man, could sail out into the void if the need arose for extravehicular activity. The equatorial region of the pressure sphere, the slice, as it were, from Capricorn to Cancer, enclosed a slowly rotating drum, 35 feet in diameter. As it made one revolution every 10 seconds, this carousel, or centrifuge, produced an artificial gravity, equal to that of the moon. This was enough to prevent the physical atrophy which would result from the complete absence of weight, and it contained the kitchen, dining, washing, and toilet facilities. Around the rim of the carousel were 5 tiny cubicles fitted out by each astronaut according to taste and containing his personal belongings. Only Bowman's and Poole's were now in use, while the future occupants of the other 3 cabins reposed in their electronic sarcophagi next door. The spherical pressure hull formed the head of a flimsy arrow-shaped structure more than 100 yards long. Discovery, like all vehicles intended for deep space penetration, was too fragile and unstreamlined ever to enter an atmosphere or to defy the full gravitational field of any planet. She had been assembled in orbit around the Earth, a creature of pure space, and she looked it. Immediately behind the pressure hull was grouped a cluster of 4 large liquid hydrogen tanks, and beyond them, forming a long, slender V, were the radiating fins that dissipated the waste heat of the nuclear reactor. At the very end of the V, 300 feet from the crew compartment, was the shielded inferno of the reactor, and the complex of focusing electrodes through which emerged the incandescent star stuff of the plasma drive. This had done its work weeks ago, forcing Discovery out of her parking orbit around the moon. Now the reactor was merely ticking over, as it generated electrical power for the ship's services. By 1600, Bowman would have finished his inspection, and would make a detailed verbal report to Mission Control. At 1800 hours, Poole would awaken, and he would hand over command. He would then have 6 off-duty hours to use as he pleased. Poole's program was a mirror image of his own, and the 2 schedules dovetailed together without friction. Both men were too intelligent and well-adjusted to quarrel, and the voyage had settled down to a comfortable, utterly uneventful routine. The greatest hope of Discovery's little crew was that nothing would mar this peaceful monotony in the weeks and months that lay ahead.